Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 108, the American Psychological Association Convention Sampler Part 2, August 27th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional. Welcome to part two of my APA convention sampler. I attended the conference for 2 days, and I didn't stay for the whole time on the second day, and consequently, I've only got 3 audio segments to share with you. The first one is with the president-elect of the Division on Individual Practice. Now, this is the APA division that I think most clinical psychologists in private practice would tend to join. And I just happened to sit down next to Jana in a lounge area to try to figure out which session to attend. And I struck up a conversation and realized that she'd actually be a great person to interview. The second clip that you'll hear is with an Israeli grad student at the Institute for Transpersonal Psychology, which is located in the San Francisco Bay Area. Rather by accident, I wandered into a panel presentation where all the presenters were from the Institute. He was halfway through his presentation. I was very pleased to see that APA has become hospitable to a broader range of psychology than would have been the case some years ago. For example, there were several presentations on Buddhism as it relates to psychology. Unfortunately, I didn't make it to any of those sessions. But let's take a listen to these first 2 clips. Okay, why don't you start by telling us your name?
Dr. Jana Martin.
And Dr. Martin, I see you're wearing a ribbon here. It says 42nd anniversary of Division 42. Why don't you tell us what Division 42 is and your role with it?
I'd be delighted to. I'm president-elect of Division 42, which is the Division on Independent Practice. We're the largest division within APA, and our focus is on providing clinicians in independent practice, whether full-time or part-time, with tools to help them stay in practice, expand their practice, and figure out better ways to serve the public and the private citizens.
Okay, well, that's actually a division I should have some knowledge of since I'm trained as a clinical psychologist, but not currently in practice, so I'm not totally up to date. How many members are there in Division 42?
If you count every listed body, we have close to 5,000 members.
Wow, and you're the president-elect, is that right?
That's correct. I start my term in January of 2008 as president.
What are the big issues that are before the division on independent practice?
Well, certainly one of the main issues that our members are concerned about are reimbursement rates and parity issues, so that when they submit for insurance, even if it's non-managed care, that they can be reimbursed at an equitable rate to physicians or other medical personnel who are providing services. One of the things that we're also trying to work on is helping independent practitioners learn how to be good business people. Because when most of us were trained, we didn't get courses on how to run a business, how to sign a lease, how to do a professional will, how to conduct ourselves as business people. And so Division 42 is really taking a look at that. One of my initiatives that will start next year is the idea of profiting from partnerships. And this year at this convention, we have several workshops on collaborative relationships with healthcare providers. And we're teaching 42 members and non-42 members how to establish those relationships with physicians, dentists, gynecologists, obstetricians, all kinds of healthcare providers to complement their services and to put psychology within the healthcare arena where it belongs.
Okay, well, that's all very interesting.
The whole issue of parity with the medical profession, boy, that's been around forever. That was a hot issue when I got out of graduate school sometime way back when. And what was the other major issue?
We were talking about the business issues and helping.
Oh, yes, the business issues. That's another biggie because, again, hearkening back to when I was in graduate school, nobody touched on that. It was such an ivory tower conception, you know, that you're going to be a professional. But there was no talk about how you rent an office, how you find insurance, how you promote yourself. Whereas other disciplines, I later discovered, for example, chiropractic, a big part of their training was related to that.
That's correct. And so I encourage independent practitioners, again, whether they're members of 42 or not, to look at the Division 42 website, and you'll see already some practice tips. APA, of course, in its practice directorate has several tips, but there's a task force that I'm appointing called TIPS, and it stands for Tools for Independent Practitioners. And we're going to put together some toolkits that have fact sheets that are downloadable from the website that teach psychologists how to run a business effectively. Now, of course, we'd prefer for people to join Division 42 to have access to these particular materials. But I do think it's vital because a lot of psychologists don't make good investments. They don't get prepared, and then a crisis arises, and their business is hurt.
Okay, well, most of my listeners are not professional psychologists. Some are. But most are intelligent adults who are interested in learning more about psychological topics, as well as a certain number of students who are planning careers. Just to close things off here, I'm wondering, are there any controversial issues that are before Division 42?
Well, probably the most controversial involves where to sit at the table of negotiations of managed care versus non-managed care. Most independent practitioners are trying very hard to move away from managed care. And part of our difficulty is many consumers have no idea how managed care really works and how they're the ones that are suffering from the full range of appropriate benefits from their insurance company. As professionals, however, psychologists cannot talk to their clients about how to bug the insurance companies, but I would encourage consumers to be intelligent consumers and to look at their insurance policies and figure out, well, what kind of fee am I paying? Who's profiting from this fee that I'm paying? Is it me? And if it's not, then they might want to have an active voice in insurance planning, as well as in, if they work for companies, talk to their human resource departments about how, you know, this is not acceptable. It says I have this many visits, but I really can't get this many visits. So we'd like for the consumers to be very informed. We just have to be careful when we're providing actual services to a client that we don't advertise that, or that we don't try to use our position and our relationship to influence it.
Okay, but I can say, go out there and bug your insurance carrier.
That's right, as well as government officials. A lot of the insurance panels and reimbursement rates are regulated by the government in one way or another in terms of what they can charge and how much they can earn themselves. And so it's just an important thing for consumers to be more knowledgeable for their own sake. Also to understand that there are many ways to deal with health issues other than just taking medications, and psychologists can really help in that arena.
Yes, indeed. What you've triggered for me is I'm wondering if you saw Michael Moore's movie Sicko and maybe how that relates to what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I did see it, and it does relate very much to what I have been talking about, where I believe consumers just assume that the care that they're getting is the best care they can get. And I think one thing that Michael Moore highlights, among many others, is that many times they're not getting the best care. They're getting the care that the insurance executives, who are not trained in medicine or psychology, think they need. And I think consumers are a better judge than the insurance executives.
Okay, well, Dr. Jenna Martin, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
I just sat in on a panel presentation that was extremely interesting by a group of faculty and students at the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. And it's very exciting to find that the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and people who are interested in spirituality and transpersonal psychology actually can find a home here at the American Psychological Association Convention. And right now I'm with Mr. Yossi Amram from Israel, who is one of the presenters.
Thank you.
And I came in the middle of Yossi's presentation, but quickly realized that he was on to something important. And so perhaps you could kind of give us the top line summary of your presentation. Seemed to be about spiritual intelligence. Tell us what spiritual intelligence is.
Well, spiritual intelligence is basically the ability to apply and manifest spiritual qualities and values in daily life to enhance functioning and well-being. So it's about the integration and application of spirituality through qualities such as humility or forgiveness or peaceful surrender to truth, that if we embody them in daily life, we tend to do better and have a better well-being and perform better at work and relationships. So it's intelligent, it's adaptive, but it draws on spirituality.
When I came in, you were in the midst of your presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, and it was clear to me that you had done some research, but I came too late to know who it was you were researching and exactly how you were going about it. So maybe you can tell us a bit about that research and what you found out.
Sure. The research involved couple of approaches to define and operationally measure spiritual intelligence. So first we started with qualitative interviews of 71 leaders across different spiritual traditions, whether it's Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Taoism, and other spiritual traditions. And we interviewed those leaders. They were both spiritual leaders as well as business leaders, about how they drew on spirituality in their daily life, in their work, in their relationship, and how it helped them. And from those interviews, we identified 7 major themes about the application and integration of spirituality in daily life. And those were things involving finding meaning through service, or having an I-Thou orientation to human relationships, or having a sense of connectedness or being part of the cosmos or something bigger than oneself, or finding an inner directed compass, the inner conscious, and learning how to listen to that. So those were all themes that were universally true across traditions, that these spiritual traditions seem to cultivate a universal set of values that are adaptive, that are intelligent, so regardless of their cosmology. So aligning with the sacred is adaptive, whether you're a Jew, which you do that through the scrolls of the Torah, or if you're Christians, you do that through Jesus, or you're a shamanic Native American person, you do that sitting under a tree. But the capacity to align with the sacred is intelligent. So the exciting thing is that we're finding universal qualities across traditions that are promoting well-being, mental health, and better functioning.
Religion has been so divisive so much of the time, so this sounds like important work in terms of the potential to be more integrative and to show the common themes that cut across.
Certainly, and that was actually one of the exciting themes that the majority of the participants who were nominated by their peers as people who embody spirituality actually spoke about how they drew on more than one tradition. So even when they identified themselves as Christians, they talked about studying Buddhism or practicing Buddhist meditation or Jewish texts or what have you. So these people drew on multiple traditions, respected multiple traditions, and found value in the wisdom of the teachings of multiple traditions. Now, in response to your earlier question, I forgot to mention that we also developed a scale to measure this and found that it indeed predicts functioning and well-being. So we have a a scale that has strong psychometric properties that's based on these qualities. So it's actually measurable.
Okay, and this scale, in other words, would measure spiritual intelligence. Is that available online in case my listeners wanted to assess their own spiritual intelligence?
Not yet, but we'll be working on that in the next year. So currently it's a working paper, but it hasn't been published online yet.
Okay, and I gather that you're a graduate student, although the way you present your material, you could be on the faculty, it seemed to me. Is this part of your doctoral work?
Yes, it is part of my doctoral.
And it's going to be part of your dissertation?
Yes, it is.
And I saw you on the program that you have a couple of master's degrees already. What are those in?
In engineering and business and in psychology. So
it's an interesting blend. Thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
As I said earlier, I'm really glad the APA tent is big enough to hold the spiritual investigations, such as represented by the person you just heard and by the whole group from the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology. I was sufficiently impressed by two other presenters from there that I'm planning to give them each a full interview in future episodes. The third clip is Dr. Martin Seligman of the University of Pennsylvania speaking to a large audience. Because I recorded it from my seat, the sound quality is not as clear as the two preceding clips, but I think it will be intelligible if you listen closely. At least I hope so. Now, Dr. Seligman, who was already a very important figure for his research on both learned helplessness and learned optimism, has emerged as the founder and driving force of positive psychology, which you've heard me talk about before. You may recall that I had approached him previously for a phone interview, and he referred me to a couple of his lieutenants. I approached him at this conference before he gave his speech, and he waved me off fairly brusquely. I had merely hoped to get him to say hello to you all. He said, "I don't do that." I said, "Well, I'm just hoping you'll say hello to my listeners." He said, "I don't give local interviews." I said, "But I have a global audience." But he again gave me a stern, "I don't do that." So I have to say I'm feeling a bit ticked at him, but he's an important guy nonetheless, and he did give a very inspiring presentation. And so I captured a couple of parts that I thought were most interesting. In the first part, you'll hear him playing devil's advocate, addressing the reasons not to study positive psychology, and then, of course, he rebuts each of these. Let's take a listen. And by the way, if you have trouble making out his words, you might try listening with earphones on. I think that would probably help.
And let me talk about now why you should walk out and not listen to the rest of this lecture. That is, I'm going to try to put myself in a position of the most as skeptical as you can possibly be about work in positive psychology. Well, the first objection I can think of is, and it's what kept me out of working on the positive side. As some of you know, I worked for 35 years on depression, helplessness, suicide, trauma, anxiety, and the like. And I resisted working on the positive side of life. And my reason was, the positive stuff is just about this fluffy stuff about how you feel. But what I really care about is action, behavior, what you do. And so why bother with this fluffy, epiphenomenal stuff when what we want is people having better commerce with the world? So that's what I thought until Ed Diener and Sonia, are you here today? Convinced me that the causal direction goes both ways. And so there's a Psych Bulletin article last year by them, which basically asked the question, holding commerce with the world constant, achievement, grades, popularity, salary, if you look at positive people versus negative people, positive lives increase cognition, they increase the amount of money you earn, they increase how popular you are, they probably add between 8 and 9 years of life. Which is to say, this stuff is causal, as it turns out. So even curmudgeonly people like me convinced me it's worth being happy. It's worth being happy. You do better at work, people like you better, you're a better leader, You earn more money, you get promoted more rapidly, you're smarter by many criteria, and you probably live longer. So it's that's my answer to the first reason that you might want to walk out. The second one is that you might feel, you know, we've got Iraq out there, and torture, and Rwanda, and AIDS, and suicide. Why in the world, with all this misery in the world, should we work on happiness? You know, maybe 500 years from now, when psychology solves all those problems, maybe then we should turn to the question of happiness. And I think that's a very good political objection. Why should we devote brain power and government resources to working on the positive side of life? And I think that's profoundly wrong. And for two reasons. One, if you look at suffering people, if you look at Rwanda, if you look at suicidal people, they are not only concerned with ending their suffering. They're enormously concerned with integrity, the future of their children, the future of their family, with religious beliefs, and the like. So interestingly, even in very, Maslow was just wrong, basically. This view that there's a hierarchy, and that somehow, until you've got all these other things filled up, you can't do self-actualization. I think that's just empirically wrong. And that self-actualization, that is the positive side of life, is everyone's birthright. And it's achievable by everyone. Indeed, people in Rwanda and suicidal people and people with AIDS are very concerned with these issues. The second objection to that objection is that, you know, psychotherapy is where you go to talk about your troubles. The whole psychotherapy endeavor has been based on the interestingly untested premise that somehow if you talk about your troubles, it makes you better. But there is mounting evidence, which I'm not going to be able to present today, that getting the people to systematically talk about their strengths, positive emotion, meaning in life, does a very good end run around troubles. That is, rather than trying to get people to deal with troubles head on, we very often deal with our suffering by doing an end run around it. I'm a bridge player, and the average age of bridge players in the United States is now about 70. So when I go to a tournament, because I got a lot of my friends have arthritis and rheumatism, and they're suffering, they're in pain. They're not in pain when they play bridge. They're in pain between sessions. So I think the positive side of life is a very interesting end run. Maybe the mode we find in our outcome studies that doing something we call positive psychotherapy, systematically building the three lives, does better than Prozac and better than psychotherapy as usual against depression. Next objection is that you know it already. Your grandmother knew it, and there's nothing new here. I made a list of 20 things that I didn't know 10 years ago that the science has told me. I'll just mention some of them. One is that there's a dramatically curvilinear relationship between how rich you are and how happy you are, which basically says that below the safety net, to get more life satisfaction, you want to earn more money. But once you get to your income, and I'm going to guess the mean income in this audience is $100,000 a year. If you're thinking about giving up 3 weekends next year to earn an extra $20,000, the data are you probably shouldn't do it. That if you spend that time with your friends and your family, you will have more than $20,000 worth of incremental life satisfaction. I didn't know that. Surprising. Another one is longevity. That there are about 20 reasonably well-done studies of optimism, engagement, the positive variables, and how long you live. And covarying out the kind of stuff that you would covary out, my guess is that positive people live 8 to 9 years longer. I didn't know that. And life satisfaction. I didn't know until we did the beta weights. Remember I said there were three lives: pursuit of pleasure, pursuit of engagement, pursuit of meaning. So we asked the question, which ones of these have the strongest relationship to life satisfaction? Well, I didn't know that Hugh Hefner was wrong, and that the pursuit of pleasure has minimal relationship to life satisfaction. And then if you want a satisfying life, what you want to do is what you're doing, pursuing engagement and pursuing meaning. So that's new. I didn't know it. And finally, you might think, happiness, hopelessly fuzzy, not worth working on. So on this website, I have the 20 leading tests, psychometrically validated tests. And basically, we can now measure gratitude, forgiveness, humor, social intelligence, about as well as we measure depression, with the same reliability, stability, and validity. So this stuff is not fuzzy. So that's why I think it lets my character why you shouldn't walk out of the room.
Okay, having successfully destroyed the straw man that he set up as to why one should not pursue positive psychology, Dr. Seligman went on to a fairly inspiring vision of the future. And here that is.
What I've said this afternoon is that I believe that the positive side of life, life satisfaction, is about the building of positive emotion, the building of engagement, and the building of meaning. It turns out statistically the building of engagement and the building of meaning in 15 replications are more powerful for life satisfaction than the pursuit of pleasure. And this brings me to what I finally want to say. What's the vision here? Well, the first vision is that teaching this stuff to our patients, to our kids, to parents, in the schools, is the fulcrum for disseminating positive psychology. This is not idle material. This is not like some of the stuff I've told all my life. But then the question is, I think a chord has been plucked here, that there's resonance. There's resonance in this audience, there's resonance in MAP, there's resonance in Whitehall, there's resonance in Canberra. I've not seen a phenomenon like this in my psychological. What is going on here? Why is there resonance? And what does it say about the future of psychology, the future of what you do? Well, this is the Tracy Chapman story. So you may remember that Nietzsche and Zarathustra said there are three stages of human growth. So the first stage is the camel, in which you just sit there and you bear all the suffering. The second stage is the rebel, which you say no to this. We're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. And indeed, that's what psychology has been about. That's what the politics from the American Revolution on have been about. And look where we were from just saying no, from correcting the disabling conditions. Nietzsche's third stage was the child reborn, in which the child asked the question, what can we affirm? Okay, we're working on the disabling conditions. We're getting rid of what Tracy Chapman wants us to get rid of. But that's not enough. I'm a rose gardener. I weed. I clear the underbrush. But that doesn't grow roses. To grow roses, you have to put roses in, and you have to Chernobyl them and take real good care of them to get roses. It's not enough just to say no. It's not enough personally in your own way. It's not enough politically just to say no to what you don't like. You need to plant roses. You need to say yes to something. So I guess I'm bold enough to say that positive psychology may provide us a vision of what to say yes to. What is it as psychologists that we want to do? Well, we want to relieve the disabling conditions. We want to do what we can to deal with depression and anger and anxiety. But all of us from the very beginning wanted to do something additional. We wanted to build positive emotion in people. We wanted to build engagement in people. We wanted to build meaning in people. This is the chord that resonates, and I believe it is our future. Thank you.
Hi, this is Dr. Cheryl Smith from United Behavioral Health at the 115th APA Convention in San Francisco, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Cheryl Smith. Dr. Smith practices in Chicago, and she let me know that she'd be interested in being interviewed about Caribbean psychology, inasmuch as she originally hails from Jamaica. Well, you'll recall that in the previous APA episode, I interviewed Dr. Steve Soltz and Dr. Steve Reisner on the issue of whether APA needs to change its rules in terms of psychologists being involved in military interrogations. It turns out that the two Drs. Steve are, in fact, the major spokespeople for the position that psychologists should not be involved in any way. The two Dr. Steves were featured on Amy Goodman's radio show, Democracy Now!, and they've written quite a bit on the internet as well. In a blog after the convention was over, Dr. Steve Soltz reports, quotes, "At the convention, the APA decisively rejected this call, as well as that of hundreds of APA members at a rally and in numerous debates on the issue. The APA's Council of Representatives rejected by an approximately 85% to 15% vote the simple statement that, be it resolved, that the roles of psychologists in settings in which detainees are deprived of adequate protection of their human rights should be limited as health personnel to the provision of psychological treatment." So, amazingly, that was voted out by 85 to 15% vote. And now, the Council of Representatives has more than 100 representatives drawn from the very large APA membership. The online version of Wired Magazine gives the following account. "American Psychological Association takes controversial stand on torture." This is written by Brandon Keim, K-E-I-M, on Wired Science. And he writes, "Responding to evidence that mental health professionals helped design tortures used at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, the American Psychological Association has taken a position on torture. On Sunday, reports the Associated Press, the group's policy council rejected a resolution that would have forbid its doctors from taking part in any interrogations at U.S. military prisons in which detainees are deprived of adequate protection of their human rights. Instead, they broadly condemned torture and said members couldn't take part in interrogations involving mock executions, waterboarding or any other form of simulated drowning, or suffocation, sexual humiliation, rape, cultural or religious humiliation, exploitation of phobias or psychopathology, induced hypothermia, the use of psychotropic drugs or mind-altering substances, hooding, forced nakedness, stress positions, the use of dogs to threaten or intimidate, physical assault, including slapping or shaking, exposure to extreme heat or cold, threats of harm or death, and isolation, sensory deprivation and overstimulation, and or sleep deprivation used in a manner that represents significant pain or suffering, or the threatened use of any of the above techniques to the individual or to members of the individual's family. Supporters of the APA's decision say that having psychologists around helps prevent these tortures from taking place, but the band's critics are less sure about the value of compromise. And he quotes Leonard S. Rubinstein, executive director of the group Physicians for Human Rights, said the psychologists had fooled themselves into thinking their continued presence at detention facilities would make a difference when they actually were playing only a supportive role. "It's unfortunate the APA did not recognize you cannot practice ethical psychology in interrogation settings in the context of pervasive violation of human rights," he said. So that's Wired Magazine's take, and it's interesting that APA spells out all of these abuses. I mean, it's wonderful that they're taking a stand against all of these abuses, which in fact are abuses that have already occurred, or certainly techniques that have already occurred that in fact do seem to be a kind of psychological torture, and that they chose to list all of those specific practices instead of adopting the very straightforward and simple proposition, be it resolved that the roles of psychologists in settings in which detainees are deprived of adequate protection of their human rights should be limited as health personnel to the provision of psychological treatment. Personally, I would have, if I were there voting, I would have voted for that resolution, which is simple and clear, as opposed to the spelling out of specific techniques, which also leaves then a giant loophole to introduce other techniques that perhaps were not spelled out. Now, in a blog that Dr. Steve wrote on a site called American Dreams, they include a letter from a noted psychologist, which I would like to share with you. He writes, an even more dramatic development in the struggle occurred this week when psychologist and New York Times best-selling author Mary Pfeiffer, author of Reviving Ophelia, among many other books, decided to return her Presidential Citation Award from the American Psychological Association in protest. Here is her letter to APA President Brehm explaining her decision. The letter is dated August 21st, 2007. President Brehm, I'm writing to inform you that I'm returning my presidential citation dated 2-02-06 and awarded to me by then-president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Gerald Kucher. I have struggled for many months with this decision, and I make it with pain and sorrow. I was honored to receive this award and proud to be a member of APA. Over the years, I've spoken at national conventions many times and had enjoyed an excellent relationship with the APA and its staff. With this letter, I feel as if I'm ostracizing a good friend. I do not want an award from an organization that sanctions its members' participation in the enhanced interrogations at CIA black sites and at Guantanamo. The presence of psychologists has both educated the interrogation teams in more skillful methods of breaking people down and legitimized the process of torture in defiance of the Geneva Conventions. The behavior of psychologists on these enhanced interrogation teams violates our own Code of Ethics, 2002, in which we pledge to respect the dignity and worth of all people with special responsibility towards the most vulnerable. I consider prisoners in secret CIA-run facilities with no right of habeas corpus or access to attorneys, family, or media to be highly vulnerable. I also believe that when any of us are degraded, all of human life is degraded. This letter is as much about us as it is about prisoners. In our ethics code, we agree to promote honesty and accuracy. Our involvement in these projects has been secretive and dishonest. Finally, as psychologists, we vow to do no harm. Without question, we violate this oath when we allow people in our care to be deprived of sleep or subjected to sensory overstimulation or deprivation. I cannot accept the August 19, 2007 reaffirmation of APA's position against torture, substitute motion 3. Under this motion, psychologists will be allowed to continue working on interrogation teams that are not subject to the Geneva Conventions. This motion places our organization on the side of the CIA and Department of Defense and at odds with the United Nations, the Red Cross, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Medical Association. With this reaffirmation, we have made a terrible mistake. I know that the return of my presidential citation from Dr. Kucher will be of small import, but it is what I can do to disassociate myself from what I consider to be a heinous policy. All of my life, I've tried my best to stand up for those with no voices and no power. The prisoners our government labels as enemy combatants are in this category. I return my citation as a matter of conscience and in the hopes that the APA will reconsider its current unethical position. We've long been a wonderful organization that respected human rights and promoted tolerance, kindness, and peace. Nothing is more fundamental to our core orientation and professional service to others than our commitment to all people's inherent dignity, safety, and welfare. I hope my letter may be useful in restoring the APA to its long-respected and important stance as a beacon of integrity and kindness for all human beings. Respectfully, Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. I don't know how to pronounce her name. Dr. Mary Pfeiffer or Piffer. At any rate, that is certainly a powerful letter and a powerful and, I hope, meaningful gesture. And I come down squarely on her side. And it's really a shame because the APA Code of Ethics has long been a document for psychologists to be very proud of. They take very strong ethical stands on quite a few issues that relate to the conduct of psychological research and the conduct of psychotherapists vis-a-vis their patients. Unfortunately, in this particular instance, it seems that our code of ethics is behind the curve.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio. Shrink wrap radio.
It's shrink wrap radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
By the way, unlike the APA vote of 85% to 15%, we have the opposite trend in our poll on our Shrink Wrap Radio website, where so far 66% of you have voted that APA should forbid psychologists to be involved in interrogations. And I'll be leaving that poll up for a little bit longer if you haven't had a chance to vote yet. I think you understand the issues now, so where do you stand? I want to remind you that our sponsors are Podshow and GoDaddy, where you can get a 10% discount at checkout by using the code SHRINK3. There are no new additions to our Frapper map. Please add yourself if you aren't on there. It feeds my fantasies of global conquest. And speaking of feeding my fantasies, I noticed that a few people responded to my call for getting some more reviews on iTunes. And so thank you so much for that. It's gone up from 19 reviews to 22. And I hope that even more of you will put your reviews up there, helping to capitulate us into broader awareness, okay? And I already mentioned the Frapper map. Okay. I also want to remind you about my interview on my other podcast at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. It's with Steve Levenkron, a New York City psychotherapist who works with women around early childhood sexual abuse. So if you're at all interested in that topic, you'll appreciate that interview. And by the way, each of my interviews on Wise Counsel have a text transcript of the entire interview, which you can download and print out at no cost. I also want to remind you that our first 32 shows are not in the feed. So, for example, if you've recently discovered the show and are getting it in iTunes, as most listeners are, you'll see that shows 33 and on are there. As each new episode comes out, another one of the old ones will drop off the feed in order to keep the feed reasonably small. So there's a lot of good material in those older shows, and they are available on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. You just have to go to the website, and in the left-hand gutter, you'll see a listing by month, and just click on the earliest months, and that'll get you to those shows, which you can either listen to right on the site or download to your computer, and then, if you want to, transfer it to your MP3 player.
Hi, this is Art Cervantes from the San Francisco Apple Store, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
It just so happens that the Apple Store, the great San Francisco flagship Apple Store, is around the corner from where the APA conference was being held. So, of course, I could not resist cutting out of APA, hanging out at the Apple store to look at those iPhones. Now let's see if we can catch up on some of the wonderful emails that we've been receiving from you wonderful listeners out there. I got one from Jeremy who writes, "Hello, my name is Jeremy, and I've been a fan of your podcast for some time. I'm currently a student at San Joaquin Delta Community College and an active member in the psychology club on campus. I wanted to ask you if you do some kind of guest speaking engagements, and if so, maybe you would consider visiting our school. Delta College is located in Stockton, California. It's a good drive from the Bay Area, but certainly in range. As I said, I've been a fan of your podcast, and I think it would be a great opportunity for students to be able to hear you. My club, Delta Psi, often invites guest speakers from other schools as well as professional psychologists working in consulting or school psychology. My club has about 30 members, although we expect more to sign up as it's the beginning of the semester. I'm sure that my fellow students would love to have you come in as a guest speaker someday. I just want to know if you would consider being a guest speaker so I can ask them to host you. I understand if the distance is too far or if you have other engagements. I hope to hear back soon. Keep up the great show. Gotta love you." Jeremy, thanks very much for your positive review and also for the invitation. And I've communicated now with Jeremy in response to this, and I am planning to go and speak to that club. Yes, I do like to speak, and particularly to help spread the word for Shrink Wrap Radio, spread the word to students who have questions about psychology. And as you know, I'm also interested in doing workshops in your local area. So if any of you want to get together a group of people and have them all pay a little money, you can fly me anywhere in the world, and I'll come and I'll do a workshop for a weekend or a week or whatever. Next comes a fascinating letter from the Netherlands. "Hi, Dr. Dave. My name is Laris, a 36-year-old woman from the Netherlands and a longtime listener to your show. Yours was the very first psych podcast I was able to find when I got my first iPod in 2005. I'm very impressed with the variety of subjects you come up with as well as the depth of your interviews. You really seem to have grown in your role as a podcast presenter. I used to be a radio presenter myself, and I notice you mention your dislike of ums and ahs a few times. I myself felt quite self-conscious about my own umming, but it never seemed to bother other people as much as it bothered me. But hey, maybe you're a perfectionist like I am." Yeah, a little bit. She says, "I'm not as much a perfectionist as I used to be and have become better at deciding what issues need my focus and which to a lesser degree. Recently, I've decided my focus needs to be on becoming a counselor. Your show has helped me greatly in making this big decision because it's helped me realize this is really for me. So thank you, Dr. Dave. My plan is to first become a counselor in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, this doesn't take too long. This way I can work as a counselor and at the same time study to be a clinical psychologist. I've always been very interested in psychology, but it never seemed like something I could actually do since I never finished high school. I found school unbearably boring, and it felt pointless to learn stuff I was never going to use. So I started at the highest level of education, was put down a level, and left school without a diploma. Being bullied didn't help, although it stopped once I became a punk rocker. If you can't join them, rebel against them, I suppose. When I was 16, I left home and my parents' psychological and physical, but not sexual, abuse. I was always seen as a difficult child and could not be who they wanted me to be. I've spent years trying to conform and rebel at the same time." That's a good trick. "I joined the left-wing protester scene, lived in squat houses in London and Amsterdam. In my 20s, I moved back to the quieter east of Holland. I continued the Rogerian psychotherapy I'd started in Amsterdam. I saw my therapist once a week until my latent eating disorder spun out of control and I ended up in the psych ward of my local hospital. This was only for 3 weeks, and I then joined a CBT, that's a cognitive behavioral therapy group, for women with autonomy issues. This worked. I picked myself up and applied for a volunteer job at a local radio station. Success. Moved on to a paid job as a TV presenter on a regional station and a talk radio station in Amsterdam. Things were going well, too well. I wasn't used to things going well, and looking back, this frightened me. So I fell in love with an English truck driver and moved to England. I even got married, which nobody expected me to ever do. Perhaps my biggest act of rebellion, as everyone was shocked. I had a difficult year and a half in England, so in the end, my husband and I moved to the east of Holland. The already existing verbal abuse became more and more physical. In the meantime, I continued my career in radio and at last made it into national radio, something I'd always wanted, though it turned out to be a great disappointment. I again tried really hard to be what I wasn't. I finally wisened up and left my marriage and also lost my job. Gone were the two things I had tried so hard to hold on to. But I felt free, relieved. Ha! I am who I am. It all makes sense to me now. I've known for about 5 years now that I've got ADHD. It's taken a long time, but I'm finally happy with who I am today. I nowadays work with the elderly as a community care worker, something I never thought I would like. My life's changed greatly since my diagnosis and medication. I now understand and accept myself as I am. I'm always on my side, and that always feels better than I ever imagined. So there you go, the life story of someone with ADHD. I hope you didn't fall asleep reading my long email, Dr. Dave. I'm planning to write a whole book, someday, that is, when I've got the time and the patience. So thank you for reading my email. I doubt you'll be reading it on your show, but feel free. Like, wrong. I did read it. You mentioned you would like to interview people on your show who've been in therapy. If it would be of interest to you and your listeners, I would really like to contribute. For now, take care and keep up the brilliant work on Shrink Wrap Radio. Kind regards, Laris. And she's at a place called Almelo, the Netherlands. Laris, and I don't know if I'm saying your name right, thanks so much for sharing your story with us. Really fascinating and kind of wonderful to see how you were able to come through after so many setbacks and rebellions and so on. It's kind of a developmental process that a lot of people go through. And yes, I would be interested in interviewing you. That's something I would like to explore with you, particularly if you're on Skype. If you're not, see if you can arrange to get on Skype and we will talk. And I might put you on Shrink Wrap Radio or might be more appropriate to put you on Wise Counsel. We'll have to think about that. But once again, thanks for writing and sharing your story. Now, here's a fascinating one. Dear Dr. Dave, my name is Peter, and for 8 months, I've been on Second Life. This is a virtual world on the internet where people can interact with each other and develop skills which are unlimited and only restricted by your imagination, which can be opened up to levels that are unbelievable. People with disabilities can be involved in making friendships. You have an avatar, a person that represents you that is so real and can look incredible that it has to be improved, and this happens as you get more skill. It used to be text-driven. You had to type to each other, but now you can speak. I think the potential to help people get confidence in real life is incredible. I have lots more to tell about the medical side. I have a partner there who is interviewing medical facilities there, of which there are many. I would say this is the next step on from podcasting. They have universities there, also lecture halls. You can meet up with people from all walks of life. Your avatar interacts with other people in that it has a profile that people can look at, in which you can put interests where you come from, the places you like on Second Life, of which there are many thousands, also what you do and what you like in the real world. I hope this explains in an understandable way what Second Life is all about, and hope I can tell you more if you have time. It's one of those things taking part is best to explain, does not even come near the experience. I'm sure my partner would love to talk to you more online, medical side, and there must be many more people in Second Life that could talk to you on your medical level. Maybe you do your show there, the first podcast from Second Life. There are 12 million people involved there. Well, Dr. Dave, must go. Real life calls. Hope you are well. I've listened to all your shows now over the last year or so, would not have written this Second Life, and my interaction with other people there has given me the confidence to do this. Regards, Peter. Hey, Peter, thanks for writing to us about Second Life. Yes, I've been quite aware of Second Life. I'm very interested in it. Hey, I've been around since the very first adventure games were being played on mainframe computers. There was one called, I think it was called Adventure, and it was entirely text-based, and it was sort of like a puzzle game where you had to kind of figure out the clues in order to progress in it. And but I'll tell you, First Life for me right now is so busy that I just haven't had time to get into Second Life. I've taken a virtual tour of Second Life. Man, I just don't have time to learn all the ins and outs and how to dress up my avatar and so on. I was a big fan of the Neil Stephenson book, Snow Crash, a really wonderful science fiction book that was written before Second Life came out. And Second Life bears so much resemblance to a virtual reality that he describes. I highly recommend that book to anybody who hasn't read Snow Crash. Really, really a cool book. I've thought that I might need to hire somebody local here to just come and give me a live tour of Second Life and maybe get me started on it. But I'm kind of afraid to get into it, just that I'll get lost in there and it'll eat up all my time because I really see that it has that potential. The other thing is, as I was exploring it, and I've read some about it, is that there's so many people there that I understand the server is really slow to respond. And I'm not sure I've got the patience for that. You know, I want something that's, if it's going to be interactive, I want it to be really interactive and really fast. And when I checked into Second Life, it didn't seem to have that quality. And as far as being the first podcast there, too late for that. There are other people who I believe who are doing some podcasts from within Second Life. I know that Adam Curry was talking about it. I think he was in contact. Some of his fan base were doing things like that. Peter, I would love to talk to your partner about what's going on there. You said that there's a lot of medical stuff there. I think maybe you were referring to what I would call psychological stuff, and maybe your partner knows something about that. In fact, I know that there, some time back, when I was looking into Second Life, there was a counselor or psychotherapist who was advertising his services there so that you could go into Second Life and receive counseling there within Second Life, and you pay for it with Linden dollars. So it's a fascinating world. Here's one from Brandy, who I believe has written in the past. She writes, "Dearest Dr. Dave, I hope this letter finds you well and in great spirits." In fact, it does. "I have been meaning to write you again for some time because the last several episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio have been phenomenal." And I give emphasis to phenomenal because she put it in all caps and three exclamation marks after that. She says, "Your show just keeps getting better and better. Your guests have become even more interesting and provocative. The guest, her name eludes me now, whom you bantered back and forth about Jung and Freud with, was a spectacular guest. I think the guest you're referring to is Gail Delaney. She goes on to say, though I am biased against her due to my master's degree in psychoanalysis, I love Freud and Jung. It was stimulating and enlightening to hear such a unique perspective on the topic of dreams. To be completely blunt, most speakers on the topic of dreams strike me as fruity and not academic, but she was fantastic. Her method of dream interpretation empowered the dreamer, and she gave some very practical mental toys we could play with at home. She was articulate and respectful of your views. Your other recent interviews have been thought-provoking and have led me to explore elements of psychology that I'd previously neglected. Thank you, Dr. Dave, for sharing so much of your own experience when speaking with your guests. We therapists tend to hide nicely behind the curtain, never to expose our own vulnerabilities, and it's refreshing to hear your human experiences and stories. Thanks again for sharing the wonderful world of psychology with lay people and professionals alike. I will continue to be shrunk and wrapped. And she spells wrapped, R-A-P-T, which is yet another play on words that I hadn't thought of that one. I love that, shrunk and wrapped. Warm kudos, Brandy. Well, Brandy, warm kudos right back to you. Well, you've heard me mention my obsession with the iPhone, my planning to get one, still holding off a bit for reasons I won't go into here. But here's another listener who listens on the iPhone. She writes, I think it's a she. Hi, Dr. Dave. I meant to answer this 2 shows ago. I frequently listen to Shrink Wrap and Wise Counsel while on my daily hour-long walk, which includes areas that have poor cell phone reception, or I would have just sent a note while walking. Anyway, I did forget to do so and apologize for not answering your request earlier. I have been listening to your podcasts on my iPhone since June 30th, and yes, I was in line on June 29th and then waited for activation. I really enjoy my iPhone, named Iris, after the Greek messenger goddess. Ask your listeners if anyone wants a month-old Trio 680 and all the gadgets and additional software one could want. All that is sitting in a box now. My digital heart belongs to Iris. Hope that you enjoy your BlackBerry as much. I do like my BlackBerry, and that's one thing that's holding me back from making the move. But I know I'm going to love the iPhone as well. She goes on, it will be very interesting to watch the iPhone market develop. I very much enjoy both of your podcasts, and I'm about halfway through the Wise Counsel library and have listened to numbers 25 through 106 of Shrink Wrap. Take note there, Terry, that you can listen to 1 through 25 by going to the archive area on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Terry goes on to say, you have quite an interesting mix of topics. I have liked the Jungian-oriented themes best of all, followed closely by Dream Topics and the 2 Tarot podcasts. The interview with Maureen Murdoch is my all-time favorite, having nearly a 100% application in my life. Please keep up the great work. I've laughed and cried and learned on those many walks with your podcasts. I appreciate the show notes on your website, as many times I've referred to them after listening to a particular podcast. Most gratefully, Terry. Terry is spelled T-E-R-R-E, so I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right or not. My apologies if I'm getting it wrong. You may not be in the U.S., and this may be a foreign spelling. I don't know, but I sure do appreciate your note. And that you've laughed and cried, I haven't heard that before, and I really like both of those, that there's something emotionally moving here in these podcasts. That means a lot to me. And also your remark about the show notes. Nobody ever commented on those before, and we do put a little effort there to make sure that the show notes are there. So that's great. So it's been great to catch up on some of these emails, and I have more to catch up on, and I'll get to those in the next show. But I think that'll do it for today.
Hey, this is Matt Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
That's my son, Matthew, who you will be hearing more of on the very next podcast. So you can send your emails to shrink at shrinkwrapradio. You can leave your voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. You're encouraged to leave voice messages on MyChingo, where there's a logo on our website that you click on and you can record there. And you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. School is starting up again, so all you students, you can help us to grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your fellow students, your professors, your friends, your colleagues. If you have a podcast or a blog or MySpace or LinkedIn page, put a link and plug us there. Now, our next podcast will feature an interview with Dr. Edward Tick, who does truly remarkable and inspiring work with veterans suffering from the post-traumatic stress of modern warfare. And as I mentioned, I'll be assisted by my son Matthew, visiting from New York City. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.